Welcome to Venturi's Voice. I'm Andy Davis. Venturi's Voice brings together thought leaders from a variety of industries who are taking the most innovative approaches to leadership and staffing. Imagine having a mix of experienced mentors sharing their secrets on leadership, recruiting, onboarding, engagement, and motivating, as well as stories on life lessons they've learned along the way. And it's free. If you're the head of a major corporation leading a team of hundreds or about to take on your first leadership role, this podcast is for you. This show is about you, and we're here to help you become the best leader you can be. Stay up to date with the latest shows by subscribing on iTunes and SoundCloud, as well as signing up to the newsletter at venturi-group.com, where you can find the latest IT jobs, talent, and blogs on all things leadership, staffing, and development. I'd love to hear from you, so drop me a line anytime via email at andy.davis@venturi-group.com. Any feedback or requests are always welcome. Enjoy the show.
Today's guest is Stuart Peck, Head of Cybersecurity at Zero Day Lab. Stuart regularly delivers threat briefings to FTSE-level executives and directors throughout the UK and Europe. Stuart's passionate about educating organisations on the latest attacker trends facing business today. We're good to go. So we're recording now, actually.
Okay,
which is
great.
Brilliant. Normally it kicks me out and then makes me restart. This must be a good day.
It must be a very good day for that. That's always good. Maybe there's no bugs because you've probably updated your phone or something like that. There you go, or your device. So
I'm constantly updating at the moment. I don't know what's going on, but it's like once every 2 weeks there's a new update that needs to happen. I shouldn't be worried about that, should I, from a cyber standpoint?
Well, that's a good thing. Are you Apple? Well, you said Siri, so I'm assuming you're for Apple. So that, yeah, there's lots of vulnerabilities at the moment that Apple are trying to fix. And actually Microsoft are addressing the same ones because there was a recent leak. WikiLeaks leaked a lot of zero-day vulnerabilities or state-level vulnerabilities for across platforms, whether that's in Apple, or whether that's in a whole range of things, really. So, yeah, I think it's everyone's furiously updating, essentially.
So, what's your take on that WikiLeaks? But just out of interest, is it? Do you think it's a positive thing, or
in terms of leaking CIA's sort of hacking tools and their malware they use? It's interesting. I don't necessarily think it's a good thing. I think it gives, as we're absolutely seeing, there's a piece of vulnerability at the moment called Double Pulsar. And if you follow somebody called Viz on Twitter, which I highly recommend you do, he did some research recently to work out how many public-facing systems were vulnerable. And it was something like 3 or 4% of public-facing systems had been infected with this piece of malware, which kind of runs in memory. It's kind of a really kind of neat piece of malware that or vulnerability that's been exploited, and it's quite bad because these vulnerabilities are being actively used, or these exploits should I say, are being actively used in the wild to attack people. So no, it's not really a good thing. I think it's good that we know about these things, but as soon as you disclose these tactics, you disclose these techniques used by state-sponsored hackers, then you open up the world to be able to use them en masse, and script kiddies or cyber criminals will absolutely adopt those and use them en masse to target us, which if you haven't updated recently, you would be absolutely vulnerable to. So yeah, I think it's a bad thing.
Right, interesting. I didn't actually consider updates, and that's fascinating because so many people will ignore updates because it feels like spam at the moment because you get so many, and I think that's half the reason why people don't bother. But that's good information, I suppose, to think about and consider the fact that you are vulnerable if you're not updating the latest software.
Absolutely, yeah. So it is a pain, right? And no, especially Windows, right? It feels like you can come and collect your pension by the time your Windows updates are finished sometimes because they are so big. And the recent updates, Windows took about 20 minutes on average to update, Windows 10 at least. And Windows 7 and all these kind of things took a fair amount of time as well. So if you look at that, yes, it's frustrating, it's disruptive, but there is massive benefit for doing so. If you don't update your computer, you haven't updated your computer recently. If I could provide any advice to the world, is definitely do it, because there's some pretty big attacks going on at the moment that, you know, Flash, for example, is always vulnerable. But there was a huge number of Flash vulnerabilities addressed, more than like 20 or something. So, you know, it's and some vulnerabilities that even Microsoft said they don't know how to fix. So, you know, it's a bit crazy at the moment.
Well, thank God we've got people like you then.
Yes. Well, I'd like to say yes, thank God. But there's quite a few in the industry, so it's not just me. But yes, we try our best. It's a continuous game of cat and mouse, right? So, you know, as soon as we as an industry catch up with what hackers are doing, they're already thinking about new ways to exploit people and systems, and that's kind of what I do. I'm not a hacker. I'm a social engineer, and I get involved in strategy. So part of what I do is help organizations at board level or individual users within businesses to protect themselves against cyber attacks at home and at work, and also develop a wider strategy for making sure that the companies and their customers aren't victims of cyber attacks.
Do you always feel then kind of in the industry that you are lagging, or do you ever feel like you are kind of getting ahead of the power curve?
Well, it depends on who you're talking about. If you're talking about general hackers, then yes, that we as an organization or individuals, there are some very talented defenders out there that spend a lot of time, you know, sharing their research and sharing the tactics and techniques of hackers so people can protect themselves. So I think recently there's been a huge spike in cybercrime related activities, and that's because it's the monetization of it, right? If you think about 5, maybe 10 years ago, you know, cybercrime wasn't really a word, but you know, hacking and espionage, all these things were happening, but not on the scale of today, because A, the barrier's been reduced, barrier to entry is being reduced because of things like crime as a service or hacking as a service or malware as a service. So if you're a budding cyber criminal and you want to get into doing this, which I don't recommend anyone does, by the way, then there are services you can buy or access, or there's malware you can buy for literally nothing. And all the infrastructure and all the hard work is done for you. So all you've got to do is select your targets and reap the rewards. And this has led to, you know, massive rise in ransomware, which is kind of the massive drive behind the monetization of hacking. The money that goes into kind of redevelopment of these tools within the cyber crime industry. So it is its own industry. If you look at, there's some groups out there that are making billions. There's one group that they're called Carbonac. It's made about 3.4 billion over the last 4 years in actual hard cash. You know, you think about that, it's bigger than some FTSE 100 companies. So yeah, we are catching up, and sometimes in some areas we're ahead. But it's a continuous game of cat and mouse.
And what kind of activities, like, surely that's illegal, right? If they're
yeah.
Right.
So think organized crime. Think your mafias, your kind of cartels, these kind of massive groups of, you know, organized crime. And just think about applying hacking to that. That's what it has, how big they are. You know, traditional crime, you know, like your Russian mafia, they have massive connections with cyber criminals, okay? And this is just huge, right? And they also have their own organizational structure as well. So they'll have, like, you know, you'll have like your mastermind, your kind of group of people at the top that then work with project managers, that then work with ex-law enforcement people, who then work with forgers, who then work with hackers and software developers, and actually, you know, physical. Think about some of the groups they have, like we call foot soldiers or associates they work with, who will do the physical attacks, who will actually go and steal money from cash points and stuff like this. So there's a huge kind of number of people involved. It's not someone in their bedroom. It's proper organized crime, okay? And it's huge. So yeah, of course it's illegal, but you've got to think about the bigger picture, the huge sums of monies and how protected these people are. Yes, you may get certain groups of criminals get taken down. So one of the groups, like last year, got taken down, a group called Lurk, who behind a lot of the big spam attacks going on, delivering ransomware. And there's also a whole range of other groups that have been taken down recently by the FBI. So there is definitely work that the law enforcement is doing to reduce this, but you can't stop all of it, because it's just a huge part of crime today.
Interesting. And one thing I think is interesting as well is you have people, for example, who would work on your team. And they have the capabilities to be hackers. So I suppose it is an ethical thing, isn't it? But to acquire those skills in the first place, surely wouldn't you have to be a hacker to some extent? Or is it just kind of like there's boundaries and you know not to cross them, but, you know, when learning kind of the skill set?
Yeah, okay. So I can very much clearly define that. So ethical hacking, although I don't actually manage ethical hackers, I manage a team of other people that do sort of social engineering and other types of security in terms of threat intelligence. But let's answer your question, because we do have ethical hackers at work in the business. The most really good ethical hackers that I know, and I've worked in this industry for many, many years, I know lots of them, and I won't mention names in this particular podcast because I'm sure they won't appreciate that. But what they do is they come from a networking background or a software development background or a bit of both, right? And I know one guy in particular who I spend a lot of time actually share apartment with during the week. You know, he in particular has come from a networking background, so Red Hat, and he's spent a lot of time cracking passwords and using and co-authoring tools like Hashcat, which is a password cracking tool, and these guys win password cracking competitions across the world. Definitely look them up, Team Hashcat, brilliant. But one of the things that these people backgrounds come from is generally it's a networking background, so they'll have strong foundations and understand the OSI model and all this kind of stuff, right, which the layers of the network and the layers of data from your network and transportation up to your application layer. But the foundations are there, okay? And then what they do is they're building networks, and they learn how to, by building something, if you understand how it's built, then you can understand how to deconstruct it. It's the engineer's mind, if you think of it that way, okay? Reverse engineering. If you know how to build something, you also know how to take it apart and destroy it. And it's the same with the what we call the application testers. They come from the best ones I know come from a software development background. So they've actually know how to build secure code, and therefore they can do code review because they understand the principles of secure coding. And if you talk about web applications like websites and web like software as a service, then they'll use the OWASP standard, which is talking about all the top vulnerabilities that we find in applications like cross-site scripting or SQL injection attack. And these attacks that happen on a regular basis, they're the most common form of vulnerabilities in web applications. Well, if they understand that, then they also understand how to, again, break an application. And that's the kind of foundations of ethical hackers. Now, I don't generally or have not worked with anyone that has come from a let's say, what we call a black hat background. So you have your white hat, the good guys. You have your black hat, your theoretically your bad guys who've conducted illegal activities. And you have your grey hats who sit in the middle, who kind of sometimes dabble on the illegal side, but not very much. I think the industry's changed a lot, and I think hiring someone from a black hat background is kind of questionable these days. I think if you've been involved in legal activity these days, I think it becomes harder to find the right position. Some companies will, but I know some companies won't hire those people. Where I see big growth areas from the ethical hacking point of view is if you talk about what we call bug bounty programs. So Facebook and Google and all these places now have bug bounty programs where they commercialize the hacking industry by saying, well, look, if you were going to find vulnerabilities in our system anyway, the whole rise in this bug bounty program is if you find a vulnerability and you use the bug bounty program, something like Bug Crowd or whatever it may be, and report it through that approved method and don't publicly disclose that to everyone else, then we'll pay you for it. So the people are now hacking these systems and getting paid to do it. So that's taking away people who had the potential to become cyber criminals and actually going, well, actually, I don't need to become a cyber criminal now because actually I can hack Facebook, find and hone my skills, but I get paid for it and I become part of a leadership, become on a leaderboard, or I get T-shirts, I get kudos, the kudos I would have got from hacking them anyway. So, you know, I think Google and Facebook and all these kind of organizations have disarmed potential hackers by doing that. So I think it's a good thing, right? It's a really good thing. So I hope that answers your question as well.
Yeah, no, that was fantastic. Yeah. So I want to talk a little bit about you. And it's actually very interesting that you completely changed your career path. You know, I kind of won't go into it too much, but I know that obviously you were involved in kind of recruitment sales earlier on in your career. And then you kind of obviously transitioned into the cyberspace. I wondered if you can kind of share with us kind of that journey a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, of course I will. The funny thing about my story is it's quite unique in some respects. So I have an art background. So I studied ceramics at university. And then when I left university, I was like, well, what am I going to do? When I was actually at university, I actually did some recruitment for a part-time job, covering for somebody who was on maternity leave or something like that. So I really enjoyed it. And I really enjoyed the whole process of dealing with people. It was temporary recruitment, but it was enjoyable. And so I thought, no, big student loan to pay, all that kind of stuff, I'll go into recruitment. And I did. It wasn't what I searched for, but I'd done an art degree. I've always been very technical anyway, but I decided to go with an art degree because I've been very creative. And I thought, you're going to do this once, right? I could always retrain if I needed to. So my thought process at the time was I just need to get a career. And at the time, recruitment seemed interesting and it was quite a hot topic at the time. So I went in and joined a company that specialized in technical recruitment and sales recruitment for fast-growing technology companies. So when I joined that company, I had a choice of three industries, and one of them that sounded more interesting was IT security. So I actually chose the industry I thought sounded most interesting to me. So I dealt with lots of companies over the years, built a very good reputation. And the differentiator I had as early start of my career is I spent time going on technical courses. I literally learned everything I could about that industry. I spoke to people. I spoke to CEOs of companies. I interviewed loads and loads of people learning about the technical side, the industry, the trends. And then I kind of took that and then kind of packaged that as providing that back to the industry. So after like 3 or 4 years, I've built a very good name for myself in terms of understanding not only the technical side of security, but also what was going on. So I built up a kind of knowledge transfer group, and we kind of kept in touch with certain people in the industry, and it kind of worked out really well in that sense. But where it became quite interesting is that after about 5, 6, 7 years of recruitment, I got approached by one of my clients to come and join them. And I joined them in a commercial kind of capacity. And again, it was actually a information security consultancy company that specialized in penetration testing. And that's how I got into this industry properly. So I knew about the industry, I'd been involved in it, and I'd been providing key people to some very sizable companies and some fast growing companies that were very small many years ago, now very big. So I've been helped them in that growth curve, and it was really enjoyable. But then I actually came into the industry and had a different perspective. And what I found again is that I was able to really absorb that information and be able to talk to customers at a much higher level. In fact, I still hold the record for the highest number of appointments booked in the first week in that company. I booked like 35 appointments in my first week in my job without any training, because I knew the industry already and the people. So it was quite easy to transition from doing the recruitment stuff into actually selling the services, and then actually becoming technical was already quite easy because I'd already built up the technical knowledge and done the certifications, all this kind of stuff. So yeah, it's a bit of an odd journey, but a really enjoyable one. And now I'm building my own team around Zero Day Lab, where I'm at the moment, and been here about 3.5 years now. And yeah, it's really interesting. So I talk to companies like all over the world. I do keynote speaking and I do presentations and I'm doing conferences. I'm doing Air Mic this year and all this kind of great stuff that I get invited to. But getting there and talking to companies about cybersecurity, and especially at the moment, which is a very hot topic, but getting there is no shortcut to get there. You have to, and it's the advice I give people, even people that I've just hired recently have come straight out of the military. We kind of forget in the industry how much that we know about. If you've been in it for such a long time, how much you know and how much knowledge we have to share with people, whether people in the industry or outside the industry. But there is no shortcut to that knowledge. The only way you can get it is from experience. And to people that want to do this right now, go, how do I get into cybersecurity? How do I do this? How do I make a transition from being an analyst or support guy into cybersecurity? It's actually hard work and finding in the right time and opportunity and learning about what's actually happening in the industry and building up your own knowledge and maybe taking some of the certifications that are out there to get your kind of skill sets. But everyone has a part to play in security, and part of that journey is understanding that. And so to cut a very long story short, I think the way that I've kind of made this transition is because I'm passionate about security. I love what I do. I love working with people.
And I love inspiring other people to kind of take that same journey in terms of take the plunge into doing something they love. And I think that's really important.
I mean, I think a lot of it for me as well was kind of the point of the infliction, if you like, from, you know, transitioning from kind of the, like you say, the appointment booking and the sales side to the hands-on stuff. You know, I think that normally to make that kind of transition, there has to be an element of or a motivating factor involved in order to kind of go ahead and do something like that, especially when I'm sure when you first moved into that role, you probably weren't as of a senior position as you were with the stuff that you'd already been doing in sales, because you already had the experience there. So to make that transition is, you know, it's inspiring to a lot of people, I think.
I hope so. And I think the other thing as well is that, so to give you some context around that as well, so I worked with a guy 10 years ago who now works with me here as my peer. So we both started out in recruitment, in information security. He focused on workplacing, I think it was, I don't know, IT security managers or guys that work in policies and procedures into banks and big corporates. And I focused on the technology companies and the emerging technology companies and firing people to them. The kind of irony is that I invited him to join this company, long story. We've kept in touch for years. But the roles that we're doing now, he heads up our governance, risk, and compliance. This is basically talking about information security, talking about policies and procedures, what he was doing many years ago. And I'm now also doing the technical side. So I'm looking at hacking techniques, or whether I'm looking at social engineering, or you know, doing assessments on finding people. So I spend a lot of time finding people, finding their digital footprint and seeing how a hacker would use that against them. And also things like looking at emerging technologies and using those as part of our services. So what I was doing many, many years ago, I'm now doing as well. And I think that's quite important. I think if you find something you're good at, there are definitely transferable skills. I think that's the key, that whatever you do, you have to make sure there's transferable skills.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I think so. I mean, I suppose, yeah, with that in mind, you already had built up some of the skill set necessary. But, you know, just as out of interest, do you still think that, you know, radical kind of redirection of career is a positive thing? You know, I'm under the belief that it is, if that's kind of what's for you. Obviously there's a huge scare element there for a lot of people to take on such a different transition.
Yeah, you know, I think it depends on the reason why you're doing the career change, right? So if you're absolutely, so it's the same sort of thing, right? So it's like taking a plunge into building your own business, right? If you want to build your own business, it's a scary thing to do. You have some skill sets, but you've never run a business before, so it's a new skill set and you're learning all the time. Having a massive kind of, not a U-turn, but a slight, you know, left field direction in your career change is the same kind of fear, right? It's the unknown. But as long as the intentions are there and you're trying to do something that's interesting and new and you're passionate about, then yes, of course, it's a good thing. And I think this is the whole point. You know, you've only got one career. You've got to maximize it, right? You only get one chance to be successful. And I think the attitude is that you've got to do everything you can to be as successful as you can, because there's only one roll of the dice, and that's it. You know, and we only have one life. I'm going to get philosophical that, right? But I'm a big believer in that. You've got to maximize every day and every opportunity, and I think that's the key. And that's an attitude thing, right? People that are passionate about what they do and passionate about and love who they do it for or why they do it are always more successful, because passion breeds activity and drive, and it's contagious. And that's absolutely key.
Yeah, and it's so important as well. I think a good example of kind of what not to do was, you know, my time over in incubators in LA, where, you know, at the time it was kind of it was becoming a cool thing to be involved in a startup, and people were kind of building startups just because they were like making products and, you know, attempting to do software and creating these kind of venture backed companies because it was like the cool thing to do and it was the happening thing to do. And I think obviously the building a new business one is the easiest one to kind of talk about, and that's really, you know, people can kind of conceptualize. But I do think that it shouldn't be oh, I like the idea of owning my own business, or, you know, cybersecurity is hot at the moment, so that would be sounds pretty interesting. I should get into that. Or, you know, avoiding the fad. It's avoiding the bandwagon, right? It's not about that. It's about what a genuine passion and something that you genuinely enjoy. And, you know, I think that, like, we spoke about it, and this is a little bit of a sidestep, because I do think that I encourage people, if they are really super motivated, to go after something, and it's, you know, and it's going to mean, you know, maybe a financial loss of some extent or whatever, but if you genuinely think that there's an opportunity there and it's something you're passionate about, do it. But at the same time, with that in mind, it doesn't mean you always have to be super radical just because, you know, you're into something. I still think that you can, you know, have passion maybe outside of the workspace that you enjoy. But I think kind of the point being is, you know, just because we're talking about cybersecurity and, you know, I've talked about data and information and blockchain and things on, you know, on other podcasts, don't follow that and don't be a bandwagoner. You know, have a genuine interest in something before you decide to kind of pursue it. And that's, I suppose, I just put that in as like a disclaimer to people thinking, oh, yeah, let's dive into something new tomorrow. It's like, no, it's not about that, you know.
I think that the one thing that you brought up there, which is really interesting, is the, you know, yeah, if you can make money out of a passion, fantastic. Having a passion outside of work, yes, great. You know, that's, you know, you can combine the two, right? Sometimes it's not always possible. It's not, you know, not everyone can do, you know, not everyone can work in something that they're passionate about. It's not always possible, but you can still be passionate about it, right? And that's the difference, because that still helps drive your career, okay? And you can find the things that, even in something you maybe not be, you think is a passion, you can still turn into a passion, because you love who you do, you love the services you provide, you have pride. You know, pride is very important as well. Have pride in what you provide, you know, because you're making a difference to organizations, people, whatever it may be. But also on a slight different note, you know, when I first started out, you know, cybersecurity wasn't a thing. It wasn't called cybersecurity, but it wasn't a fad or a trend, or, you know, it was very difficult, okay? Because we spent the whole time talking to organizations about the stuff that, you know, we're almost prophesizing what's happening now, and we're kind of almost going back and saying, I kind of told you this about 5 years ago, 6 years ago, even 10 years ago, this is what's going to happen. And we're still telling people the same thing, this is what's happening. So it's a continuous kind of cycle of kind of evangelizing. But no, now it's, I think, a lot my high profile, but only because it's got so bad, because companies aren't taking it seriously. So if it was, you know, 5 years ago, I'd still be saying the same thing, but a lot of people would be like, yeah, but don't really know what that is. Now everyone knows what it is. It's interesting. It's, you know, it's exciting. People are enjoying it. So, you know, I think there is a time for everything. Every industry has its kind of time. Okay. And I think that's the important thing, to be able to spot that. And be able to say, do you know what, I'm going to see out the hard times, because I know the good times are coming, because I want to get in early and be an early adopter, or I want to be someone who thinks I can become an industry expert, but actually it's going to take time to do that. So I know there's an investment and a bit of a risk, but the payoff could be huge.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, like you say, I think you talk to most people, as you stated earlier, who've had any kind of successes, you know, whether it be financially or whatnot. You know, generally the things that they push forward, you know, they have a genuine passion for. You know, you look at all the famous entrepreneurs now within, you know, the dot-com era, they all were just into computers. They were passionate about them, you know, and that's what you need to have, you know, I think, to have these tremendous successes. And the fact that they have all this kind of money or whatever, that just came along with it. You know, and I'm totally with you. I think if you genuinely enjoy what you do, you will have success on some level. And kind of, you know, maybe just if the money comes in large amounts, great. If not, you know, it's about the day-to-day things that you enjoy. And I think I value that a tremendous amount. And sounds like you kind of do as well, Stuart.
Yeah, I don't do 9 to 5. So, and that's the other thing as well, right? If you do 9 to 5, you'll always have a 9 to 5 job. I think you've got to put the hours in that, obviously I'm not going to start saying work 120 hour weeks, right? But you'll find ways to be more efficient, to always be more successful than anyone else. And that's kind of where I kind of fit into that, because I do work quite long hours, but that's by my choice. I can stop at 5 o'clock if I wanted to. I never would. because I spend a lot of my time doing research, and I research into, you know, the deeper areas of the web or the dark areas of the web. So I spend a lot of time on the dark web researching bad guys, and that helps give me more credibility when I'm speaking to people, because I can say, this is the research we've done on XYZ, and it just helps customers, you know, understand the depths that we're going into to research the problems that they're experiencing. And I think people really appreciate that. But that's about commitment, and that's just I would definitely say don't necessarily do what I do, but take elements of it, if that makes sense, because I do work abnormally long hours because I don't see it as work. It's a passion, and there's a difference, right? And I don't stop the clock at 5 o'clock and say, well, I'm stopping now, because that's what happens. I'm in it to build a long-term strategy, but also I'm in it to because I want to help people, and that's the difference. You know, if I can find something, or I can report something that helps take down a certain cyber criminal group or provides intelligence on that, then I'm all for it, and that's the difference.
Looking forward in kind of the cyber security space, how do you see it kind of playing out over the next kind of 5 to 10 years? I think, what are the things that you see fundamentally changing in your space at the moment, you know, with kind of the input of different technologies, etc.?
Okay, I don't think I can tell you what's going to happen in 10 years. I think 10 days generally is quite hard to tell you. But with all the changing stuff that's happening on a regular basis, but if I was to put my cyber strategist head on, right, I think the key things that I see as being interesting is some of the interesting technologies. So if I talk about preventative stroke detection type technology that's going to help us become better at finding cyber attacks. So prevention is always difficult in this industry at the moment, and people have almost given up on prevention, which they absolutely shouldn't. But there you go. That's another topic for another day. But so the emergence of machine learning or artificial intelligence, two different sort of disciplines, I think will help make us become more efficient. I think very much like the cyber criminals, we need to reduce the barrier to entry from an industry perspective so we can get more people in. I think the biggest challenge that we have as an industry across the board is that attracting that talent. There's always this kind of high expectation. You must have this certification. You must have this. You must have this experience. Well, yes, but there's only so many people in the industry that have experience. So we have to change our attitudes. And I think I see that coming this year. I see sort of snippets of this happening. And I think that will come with technology. There's certain technology that I work with that means that you don't need to have all this experience. You can kind of get the same results of a senior analyst by being a junior analyst, and it's the technology that's helping kind of push and reduce that barrier to entry, and I think that's really important. On the flip side, I see the Internet of Things, where people don't understand what that is. That's basically your toaster that talks to the Internet, or internet connecting your teddy bears or whatever it may be. I mean, I'm doing a talk on it in a couple of weeks, but I see that's a big, huge threat that people just don't really understand. And it's not us consumers, because we want to buy this stuff because, hey, it's pretty cool, right? My smart TV. But we don't understand the risks. And the risks are that people are connecting stuff to the internet and not understanding the benefits of and also the risks of doing so, i.e., let's just put default passwords in stuff, or let's have all these vulnerabilities that can be exploited. You know, and that's the problem, that the people that are creating these systems are ultimately building vulnerable code, which can be exploited. And that is a risk. So in summary, I don't see things getting much better, but I do see us getting better at detecting things. I see us getting better at hopefully hiring the right talent to kind of drive the future of this industry. And that's what I'm hoping for. I'm hoping to technology to help us get better at getting people into the industry so we can get better at stopping cyber attacks.
Great point to finish on, Stuart. Thanks for taking the time, mate. Do appreciate it.
That's my pleasure. No, thank you.
Thanks for listening to Venturi's Voice. Please make sure you subscribe at iTunes or SoundCloud, or check out the website, venturi-group.com, and keep up to date with the latest IT jobs, talent, news and podcasts. Or drop me a line. It's andy.davis@venturi-group.com. Any feedback, topics, or guest suggestions are always welcome. And thanks again for listening to the show. See you next time.